measurements, and we'll have David Stonestrom that will give this presentation.
Thank you. Mammoth Mountain is a dormant volcano on the rim of a caldera, Long Valley caldera in California. And this picture shows what until recently was a lush climax, vibrant forest, until cold, meaning ambient temperature, almost pure carbon dioxide started diffusing through the soil following seismic unrest in 1989. And Jory Schultz and I are looking at the effects on weathering and soil fertility, and we're collaborating with PIs who are leading investigations into volcanology, dendrochronology, and aqueous geochemistry, forest ecology, and microbiology. So the other carbon talks in this session are focusing on this large flux, 1.6 gigatons of carbon per year related to agricultural and land use changes. There's, by difference, a bigger flux coming down, but the net effect of soil management or mismanagement is a loss of 39 gigatons of carbon by this estimate in the soil. I'm going to focus on this other large flux of carbon related to fossil fuels, and the proposal for carbon capture and sequestration. So the idea is that we will be driving around in electric and hydrogen-powered vehicles, and the carbon, the waste carbon, instead of going up into the atmosphere, will be put back down into the ground. Now, there's a recognition that some of this carbon will be coming back to the surface, but the thinking is that if the half-life of the carbon in the ground is on the order of a few centuries, that helps with climate mitigation. Also, this carbon coming back up, if it promotes growth and it can actually replenish soil organic matter and so mitigate this problem here. Now, carbon capture and sequestration, there's nothing really new about this. Carbon dioxide has been used in enhanced oil recovery for a long period of time. Now it has a green hat. What's relatively new is the idea of flooding coal bed methane. These are an endless loop because we're producing more carbon as we're sequestering carbon. But the other proposal is to put carbon dioxide into a deep aquifer, so groundwater to the rescue. And the idea, again, is some of this will be reacted away, some of this will come back to the surface. And in this photograph here, the forest looks pretty happy. So this is already happening on a large scale. There are global carbon markets, and you can see these are all carbon capture and sequestration projects, and we even have it in Florida, a proposed project. These are typically on the order of half to 1.5 megatons of carbon per year. In order to get to the proposed 3 gigatons of carbon per year, roughly half of the fossil fuel carbon, we're talking about increasing this, multiply this by a factor of 50 to 100. So what can possibly go wrong? Well, as you increase the carbon dioxide in the soil, we turn the soil solution into carbonic acid, and then the hydrogen can exchange with the base metal cations on the exchange complex, and these include essential elements, sodium, magnesium, potassium, calcium. Usually these are available relatively abundant. These tend to be limiting. There's also aluminum complexes on the exchange surfaces. These are toxic to plants, and so we will release these, and the aluminum is what's implicated in the die-off related to acid rain. So the other thing we're looking at is this third equation. It's just a generic mineral weathering equation, but as we add CO2, we drive this to the right. So Mammoth Mountain is shown at the upper right. The green contour is a 2,900-meter contour. And Andrea Cook, who was an intern, mapped the tree kill areas, which are shown in red. We're going to be looking at data from soil pit transect near the largest of these emission areas near Horseshoe Lake. And the survey's been monitoring. We have 20 years of data now on the CO2 fluxes. So this is what it looks like. Healthy, this is carbon dioxide at 10 centimeters depth. Depth, when you've got about 2%, happy forest. When you get about 14%, forest starts looking stressed. And here we get up to 80%, and pretty much 20 to 80%, this is, we get complete die-off. Now, what we did, or what I did back in 1995 was I did a transect digging pits, and then in 2010, a jury came out and helped me, and we sampled at two depths and then did ammonium acetate exchange for the base metals and then ICP for the bulk chemistry. So by 1995, what I plotted here is calcium versus magnesium, potassium, aluminum, and sodium. The red are from the tree kill areas, the blue from the healthy forest. And so you can see by 1995, which is 6 years after the seismic event, we've already got a significant reduction in the base metal cations, and I'll show you why I'm plotting calcium versus magnesium. This is kind of a prototypical weathering profile. This is not from the Mammoth Mountain area, but it's a granitoid weathering, and this is work that Art White has led up. And you can see that if you look at the profile of sodium in poor water, as you go deeper, the residence time is increasing. Both the sodium and the calcium are coming from plagioclase weathering, and so we're increasing as we go deeper, increase until we get to about mineral saturation with plagioclase, and then it's constant. But if you look at calcium, the biosphere is actually capturing that calcium and holding it high in the profile, and if you look at the biomass, you've got this. Okay, the elements that are in abundant supply, the sodium and magnesium, this is the above-ground biomass, they don't cycle, but the potassium, the calcium, the ones that are in short supply do get. So in addition to the reservoirs we normally think of, pore water exchange complex, and then the big one, which is the solid phase, the mineral phase, there's a fourth reservoir, it's the second largest one, and that's this biomass. And that takes time to develop. And by plotting against calcium, you can see the difference between a biogenic signature, the hollow symbols here are shallow, pore water and the solid deep, and then magnesium and sodium, a lithogenic. So you can see this separation. You can tell what's limiting in the ecosystem. So when we went back and sampled in 2010, here I'm showing these as milliequivalents per gram of soil, because if I plot it against calcium, we're down in the noise. But you can see here that at depth, the green is healthy, the red is dead. In 1995, we had separation at depth, but not at the surface. By 2010, we're actually weathering, we're seeing exchange effects near the surface. And so it's kind of an upside-down weathering process from the bottom up. When we look at the solid phase in 1995, we didn't see any difference between the populations, healthy or dead. By 2010, we're starting to see a little separation, and so a little bit of weathering effect. So, and weathering is producing all these base metal cations, but they're obviously being flushed away. Jory Schultz did these nice scanning electron micrographs. And in the healthy surfaces, we see a vibrant community with hyphal fungi and bacteria. In the kill zone, it's a much different situation. The microbial system has collapsed. You can see relict tracts where fungi were attached, and they've etched a little bit. Mark Waldrop and Jack McFarland have been doing assays of bacteria. What they are finding is that in the healthy soils, there is a diverse fungal community supported by And when you get into the tree kill, they're just a couple different clades. They don't go down to the species level, but it's a much different story. So is there any good news in any of this? Well, there's a fertilization fringe. There's one particular tree called the Flux Tree 1. Bill Evans has a network of 27 trees where he's been looking at tree ring carbon 14, and this was actually a rejected ring because it wasn't perpendicular to the growth rings. But I corrected for SLU, and you can see the growth rate in millimeters. This is years and time. The growth rate went from 1 millimeter per year to about 4 millimeters per year after the CO2 arrived. And this is carbon 14 in percent modern carbon, or percent magmatic, is the way Bill has expressed it here. So you can see after 1989, that's when the carbon dioxide arrived. So in conclusion, the old medical adage holds here, and that is that the dose makes the poison. When we're thinking about carbon sequestration policy, we need to be mindful of our soil resource and protective of our soil resource. Slow diffuse release of carbon dioxide has consequences. Base cations are stripped. The fungal symbionts are replaced, that diverse community, by just a relatively impoverished one or two clades of decomposers. We have this nutrient loss from the biopool, so it's not just the exchange surfaces getting stripped, but we're losing our biopool that takes time to develop, because the above ground store of nutrients is an important one, and the effects apparently accumulate, and it's quite likely that we're going to a transition, a tipping point ecologically, so that if the CO2 then stopped, it's not sure we'd come back to the same community. So with that, I thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thanks, David.
We have time for a question. Somebody have a question for Dave? Yes, John?
In your study, the CO2 is natural.
It's natural, right.
So my question would be, is there any evidence pilot studies that there actually is an elevation of CO2 near the soil surface?
There are anecdotal reports, and some of them are contested. But even the piping system, I mean, pipes leak, so that's okay. When we're talking about the scale, when we're talking about taking 3 gigatons of carbon per year, scrubbing it out of the fossil fuels and injecting it, that's a lot of piping.